Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
John Steinbeck.
Oh.
Speak up, John.
Did you not bring your cot in?
John Steinbecker. Proud and awake.
You're not awake. Don't lie.
You're upright.
No, I'm not awake. Unlike the other two of you, I am a true Cubs fan.
Oh,
who doesn't have to do morning edition? I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
the game last night.
I have no excuse. Actually.
The game last night went till 2 a.m, and they eventually lost 13 innings. It was a very exciting game. And well,
they meaning the Cubs. I don't even think we've mentioned.
Oh yeah, they're playing the San Francisco Giants. Sorry. I guess I just assumed some things. But yes, I am tired. And luckily, my wife is about to come in and speak for me for a while, so that'll be nice. I'm sure I won't interject at all.
Oh.
That's wonderful.
Restraint. Come on. I missed it. I went to bed after the fifth inning, so fine.
Yeah, I pulled myself away from the TV after the third inning. Last checked my phone in the fifth in time to see San Francisco get their second run of the game,
and I missed that.
It made it 3-2, and I didn't want to go to bed, but I knew if I didn't that I would be comatose.
Right.
Right. Yeah. You of all out of the three of us,
you have a good excuse.
You
I'm
have
just
a great
trouble.
Excuse. I was going to say that I did that thing that I think Cubs fans hate, where I was, you know, Arrieta's home run was so great. He seemed to be mostly in control. So I was like, they got this. Sorry. Yeah. I know. It's maybe I wrecked it for everybody. Who knows?
I think everybody kind of had that going through their head at least a little bit that, okay, Daniel, you get a home run from the pitcher off of one of the best playoff pitchers ever in Madison Bumgarner. This has to be the Cubs' night. Well, it wasn't for lots of reasons we won't go into, but it wasn't. But anyway, that doesn't diminish our Cubs fandom.
It does not. In fact, we're about to have someone who actually might exceed our fandom and also my wife, who definitely does not exceed our fandom.
Okay, so especially recently, we know it's hard to be a Cubs fan no matter how things go, right? When things go right, it's hard to be a Cubs fan. And when things go wrong, it's also hard to be a Cubs fan. So we're here to talk about the stress of being a Cubs fan, particularly right now, but also stress with sports and being involved with sports, maybe not necessarily playing them yourself, but being so invested in a team that it affects your day-to-day household operations or personal operations. And we have a couple of guests with us here today. We have Katie Heath and we have Jill Gengler. They're here to talk about their experiences in a household of super fandom. So welcome. Welcome to the bandwagon. My first question is for Jill. Jill is a super fan, by all accounts. When we were doing pre-production for this, your name came up as a fan.
I have no idea why.
And
it's unusual.
So can you talk a little bit about your history with the Cubs and how you got to be, how your fandom went beyond fan and into super fan territory?
I was born into this situation. The Cubs had a day off on the day I was born, which was good because my mom, you know, we didn't have cable TV back then and they didn't have radios in the hospital room. And she told me that there would have been an issue had I been born in the middle of a Cubs game. So I think I come by my super fandom quite naturally. Like I was born into a house of crazies and I've maintained that kind of cultural tradition.
So now you have a family of your own.
Super fans, yes.
Are they all super fans?
They are. They don't necessarily want to admit it. My husband just sort of puts up with it, but I think they all are.
But you told me as we were coming into the studio that he fell asleep listening to the radio.
Yes.
And that was at 2 o'clock in the morning because last night's game went 13 innings. So I would say he probably goes into super fandom. So are your fandoms compatible within the family? Are they different or are they all the same?
Well, I think one of the few conditions I placed on our marriage was that my husband did have to convert. He had been a Pittsburgh Pirates fan because he grew up in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. But he became a Cubs fan in order to marry me, and that's fine. That's good. And he roots for the Cubs. He's allowed to root for the Pirates, except when they're playing the Cubs, and then he has to, you know, show fidelity. And apart from that, you know, I really, basketball, I watch the Illini, football, maybe the Illini, professional football, I don't care. He's a Steelers fan. That's good. We have a team that can win more consistently, I think, in the family, so that's nice. Mm.
So Katie, I'm gonna ask you a question now. So, describe on a level of 1 to 10, what is your fandom for the Cubs?
If I'm being honest, it's probably like a 3.
Okay. So, but you live with John Steinbucker, who is part of the Bandwagon team, and Brian and I both work with John Steinbucker,
right?
Part of the Bandwagon team. So, and as over the years, especially as I've gotten to know John, I've gotten to know the highs and lows.
There are highs.
right, exactly. Okay, so maybe that. So maybe
a lot of ups and downs.
Yes, ups and
John
downs.
Steinbucker.
Maybe right. Where the Cubs are concerned, particularly. So I'm curious to know how you, given that his fandom is probably 10 plus in terms of caring and investment, and yours is maybe a 3. Are you going along with it? Do you participate? How do you mitigate, you know, if things go well? Because I was saying to these gentlemen when the Cubs entered the playoffs that every pitch is going to be this excruciating moment of yay or it's over. How do you manage that at home?
I do not rest my head on his knee when we're sitting on the couch watching the Cubs play.
Because
every pitch, his whole body like tenses, and then I can't be near him physically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just too it's like oozing out of his pores, his anxiety.
So say the last couple seasons in particular have been, you know, the high expectations for the Cubs. This season, like no other, really, in a lot of ways. So how do you deal with a win at home? How do you deal with a loss? Because a win brings with it the expectation of losing the next game, I'm guessing.
I think,
if I know Cubs fans, not just
John's
John.
John's been a Cubs fan his whole life, and I feel like at this point it's even hard for him to get too excited about the wins just because he's a little superstitious where he doesn't want to get too excited because then he's like, I'm going to jinx it if I think for a moment that they might have a chance. So he gets really mad when he reads positive articles you know, if he hears positive commentary about Arrieta by the announcers or whatever, he's like, stop talking like that. Stop saying positive things. He'll yell at the screen so that they stop. Yeah, it's really odd. So unfortunately, I think he doesn't get the highs, you know, because it's sort of like mixed with the anxiety of the, you know, imminent low.
So you mentioned superstition and Jill was mentioning superstition and magical thinking, I think, was how you phrased it on our way in. Can you describe some of those superstitions, rituals, magical thinking?
Well, I know if I feel like the announcers or anybody's being like too upbeat or too positive, I will immediately, and I'm glad to see there's wood in here, or at least wood-like substance, I will immediately knock on the wood. And it's not just a knock on the wood. It's I have to knock 4 times. Because there are 4 letters in the word Cubs. And in my head, I'm hearing Van Halen's Jump, the J-U-M-P part, because the 1984 Cubs used that song as their intro on WGN.
Wow.
And so that's what I hear when I knock on wood. I hear Van Halen.
This goes deep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
So that's just one of many. But so to the point where I work at the university and I have student workers, many of whom are not sports fans. I work with the School of Information Sciences. Librarian students don't always roll deep with the sports. It's one of those stereotypes that comes true sometimes. So complete non-sports fans, if they hear anything about the Cubs at this point, will actually knock on wood. I think whether or not I'm in the room, I've trained them that they have to do this. Otherwise, they get in trouble.
So how do you feel about bandwagon jumpers this time of year for the Cubs? You know, like you guys have, meaning you plus Brian and John, have stuck with the team through thick and thin for so many years. And then every year in the playoffs when the Cubs are in, there's all these losers who jump on the bandwagon. How do you guys feel about that?
I haven't really met many bandwagon jumpers. You know, I've had a few people who are like, hey, yeah, I'm rooting for the Cubs. That would be pretty cool if they win. But I don't really run into too many people who switch allegiances or try and fake, you know, Cubs fandom. Mm. Maybe you just can't fake that kind of insanity.
I think that there might be something to that. I mean, who would willingly jump on the bandwagon of a team that hasn't won a World Series in 108 years?
Well, I think there's something really attractive about the Cubs, though. I mean, there's that. So it's kind of fun to, because what if you're right this one time jumping on the bandwagon? But also, I think the history of the Cubs and the tradition of the Cubs is something that I could see students working in information science being really interested in the lore of it, mm-hmm. and perhaps choosing to align themselves for that reason, but not wanting to invest themselves in 162 games during the regular season.
Right.
Maybe. So.
And personally, I say, you know, there's always room. I've got no problem with people joining in.
We always say that about our podcast, okay. The Bandwagon. Yeah. There's always room for everybody on the bandwagon. Okay, I have another question about kids in the house. So Katie and Jill are both parents and have kids at home. So Katie, you can go first and describe your kids' level of fandom and how they respond to the atmosphere in the house. Do they know when it's playoff time? Your kids are older now. I've known you guys for a few years, so they're a little bit older now. So do they care? Do they get excited? Do they stay out of the room? What do they do?
I should have asked before. I should have interviewed them coming into this. I wonder if they've noticed John's, like, stress level increase on the day of a game. But I can't answer that question. They seem clueless.
Okay.
They are 5 and just turned 8, and I think they just – John, if he has it on when they're awake, then he usually has it muted, so they don't – they're not really – I don't know. They're not – they don't seem to pay attention. They kind of run around and bring their toys in and out and do their thing, and they don't sit and watch.
The playoff games have been late.
Yeah.
So they really haven't watched many of them, and yeah – they don't really care. I mean, let's just be honest. I think Katie's scared to say that, but our kids aren't really that. Like, they're Cubs fans, but they don't really care. This 5-year-old would rather wrestle and gets irritated if I'm watching. I mean, mostly what me watching a game is an annoyance to them.
Right,
right.
He's distracted.
Occupied. Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. I see that. How about you, Jill?
My kids are a little older, and my 13-year-old is very into baseball. Like, that's probably his number one passion. So he's right there with us as far as, like, the nerves and the stress and the knocking on wood and some of the other superstitions. The 10-year-old, I think he recently discovered that if he says, hey, I want to watch the game, that he gets to stay up past his bedtime.
Oh, big draw.
Smart.
Yeah,
big draw.
And I'm like, hey, come on, sit down with us and watch Henry Moore, the merrier. And then the girl, she's 8, she's not as tuned into the games maybe. However, I will say she did go as Rizzo for Halloween last year. So we got to give her props for that. That was all her idea. And we tweeted about it, and Rizzo himself retweeted. So I'm pretty stoked.
Do you have a screenshot of that?
Wow. I've got it somewhere, yeah.
Ooh, that would be cool to put on our
family heirloom.
Our daughter likes Rizzo because his walk-up music is Taylor Swift.
That might be it. I didn't make that connection.
She also likes Rizzo of Grease.
I like Rizzo of Grease also.
Me too.
Yeah. So
something in the name, perhaps.
So, yes, perhaps. All right, related to kids, and this can be my last question because I feel like I've monopolized this. So I was talking with John earlier today about kids in the house, and then I was thinking that the only time I've ever had this level of investment in how a team does is when my own kids are playing a sport. So my daughter was a soccer player in high school, and every morning that there was a game, I would be, like, totally pumped and excited for the game. I'd be working here all day, and I'd be like, I have to leave at 3 to go to Charleston to watch the soccer game. And then I would pace up and down the sidelines, and I would yell loud, friendly encouragement at everyone except for the officials. And
you would live tweet?
I would live tweet. I was, like, super, super into it. And, of course, when her career ended, when she graduated, I've been sort of bereft since then. And I'm wondering if you feel like for you, especially Jill, but also Katie and John, also if he wants to chime in, could you guys have that level of fandom for your own kids' teams that you feel for the Cubs? Like, can you imagine being superstitious about your kids' sports teams? Were they, if they're athletes, I don't know if they are, so.
I think I just don't have the gene for fandom. It just doesn't exist in me. So even, I mean, our kids are little. They're not really competing at any high level. But just soccer practice, I just am the one on the sidelines talking to other people and distracting them from watching their children. I kind of forget to watch my kids because I guess I don't really maybe if it were a real competition and they might feel bad about it later. But thus far, they've been really flaky about it. They don't care if they kick it. So I have a really hard time engaging, and I don't know. Yeah. Group sports have just, I've never been into it myself. Mm-hmm. I like to exercise in other ways individually. I just don't like to compete. And so maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm horrible.
Oh.
I'm a terrible parent. I don't even like to watch my kids play soccer.
Oh, I don't think you're horrible. I mean, but it's interesting. I think like the fandom, the lack of the fandom gene, that has nothing to do with your kids and maybe has just everything to do with, you know, not understanding why everybody gets so uptight about the competition. Jill?
All right. So when my kid is pitching or up to bat, the superstition is you don't yell his name. You can come on, buddy. Come on. You can do it, big guy. But you don't yell first or last name. So that's kind of my personal.
Can he hear you?
I have no idea.
But that's so is that your superstition or has he asked you to not do that?
He's never mentioned it. I think he'd prefer I not call attention to him. I think he'd prefer to not really be associated with me too much. He is 13, so that's fine. But just on a personal level, I do get really wrapped up in watching him. He likes to pitch a lot. He loves to play first base. And it's always very nerve-wracking to me. And so, again, this is like my little bit of control in a situation that I can't control. It's like, okay, I can control what I say, what I do, what I think. You know, the Great Pumpkin is listening, so I will not express any doubt or, you know, the Great Pumpkin will pass us by this year. I will not talk about the fact that no one has put a bat on the ball for our pitcher's particular outing this time. I will not talk about should the Cubs happen to win, like, the next, 10 games in a row or something like that. You know, there are just some things that I will not do.
Should have taken a picture of that. Yeah, Jill was just knocking our pretend wood in here.
Oh, it's got to be real.
Do you have anything to add, Brian?
Well, it's funny to me hearing Jill talk about all the superstition and stuff because I try to, at least when I'm talking with friends and everybody about the games and about what's going on, I do whatever I can to be kind of the even keeled one. It's gonna be all right. And when I talk about my Cub fan friends about the playoffs, well, like you got to understand the playoffs are kind of a crapshoot. You just never know what's going to happen. Even the best teams have maybe a 20-25% chance of winning the World Series. So you just I try to lower my expectations a little bit. I don't take it to the same level John does.
Of lowering expectations?
Yeah.
Being so mad when high expectations don't happen anyway?
Yeah. Like I don't. If they're saying good things about the Cubs, I don't get mad about that. You know. But I do try and just keep everybody on an even keel.
Here comes John.
All right. What do you got, Steinbacher?
No, I don't get mad about them saying good things about the Cubs. I get mad about them saying things like the San Francisco Giants haven't won a game after not having the lead in the eighth inning all season, or the New York Mets have lost to the Chicago Cubs 5 games this year. There's no way they're going to beat them in the National League Championship Series. Those are the things.
So it's like anything inviting trouble?
Right, exactly.
So you believe in that hocus pocus?
No, I don't. I'm completely rational, except for when it comes to the Cubs.
He just doesn't want to hear statistics.
Oh, yeah, we're going to –
anything
gonna
that
be covered.
Well.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I say that. I try, you know, I try to keep that even keel and everything. But Carenza will tell any of you here.
I wish she was here.
And when she hears this, she'll be laughing because when I'm at home watching the game, certainly I get as upset as anybody when things go wrong. And, you know, I'll, you know, shout and yell at the TV with the best of them. But, you know, I try to keep my – I think part of this, I think, has to do with what I did for so long with Illini fans, mm-hmm. having to talk them down after games for so many years, that I kind of took on that persona with my Cubs fandom as well.
But it's not real. Deep down.
It has become real to an extent, but I can't completely turn it off.
Well, by the time this gets into the pod waves, I'm not sure what will happen.
We're talking here, game four is tonight.
Right.
If all is well, the Cubs will have advanced to the league championship series already.
Thank you.
For Jill.
Yeah. You didn't sing it to the tune of Jump, though. I'm disappointed.
No, I did
not. In my head. Yeah.
In her head, it was sung to the tune of Jump. So if all is well, then that will have happened. If not, then this will be posted before a potential game five at Wrigley Field.
Got it. Cool. Well, we would love to hear also from people about their crazy superstitions. So you can find us on Twitter and tweet your superstitions, your feelings, your lack of feelings, your complete disinterest, whatever it is, let us know what you think about sports superstition and fandom.
One that I've kind of grabbed onto this postseason, I hate to admit it, but I have a Chicago Cubs koozie for cans. I've enjoyed a cold beverage in that koozie before every playoff game. But see, the problem was, I had to go to bed last night. I wasn't up for the end of the game, so I ruined the mojo.
That was it. I fell asleep, I think, is what caused them to lose.
The two of you together.
It's our fault, Jill.
Yeah, it is. God,
get it together, guys.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try and take a nap this afternoon so I can stay up for game four. Mm-hmm.
Right on. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for this incredibly stimulating conversation, and I wish I'm not a Chicago bandwagon person. I always root for them because I lived on the north side and I grew up watching them, but I will not be destroyed if they lose. So here's hoping that things go well for you guys.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again for Katie Heath and Jill Gengler joining us to talk about their Cubs fandom. Great to have a
or lack thereof.
Yeah, or lack thereof. You know, Katie is at least a three.
Yeah,
on the fandom
scale. The interesting thing she said about sort of the genetic thing is her parents are both huge Cardinals fans.
Huge.
So I don't know. Maybe it skips a generation. Her grandfather, in fact,
or nature and nurture.
On her dad's side, huge Cubs fan. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking about bandwagon, her family is definitely on the Cubs bandwagon, not because of me, but because of her grandfather, who was a huge lifelong Cubs fan and, you know, passed away, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks again to Katie and Jill for joining us here today.
I do want to revisit this idea, like when the Illinois basketball team gets really good. About fandom,
okay.
Because I think in this room there will be some pretty serious investment. It's not the same as baseball.
I know who we're bringing in for that. We're bringing in Jeff for that if we ever do that.
Good.
So, but honestly, I love the dynamics of like people who care and people who don't, and people who are in the middle, and people who are just sort of affected by it. You know, like kids. So anyway, this is a fascinating topic for me, and I think people who are not huge sports ball fans can still, it may answer some questions they may have.
Yeah, so we talked about kind of the superstition and some things like that around fandom. And now it's time to go on a completely different tack and about how statistics and probability have, I wouldn't say taken over, but they've certainly become a huge part of sports these days.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and it's relevant right now, not just because of the playoffs, but it's also the same sort of thing that's going on in the presidential election, where you have a cottage industry of websites out there who basically every day give you the odds of who's going to be president, who's going to take the Senate, who's going to take the House, and all these other things. Whereas before, you see the polls and you're like, oh, Clinton is ahead by this much. Now it's like Clinton has an 84.5% chance of winning the election. Blah 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 blah. Well, the same thing applies to sports. we talked about a little bit how it kind of bothers me. At the same time, it's whatever. But the huge thing coming into the Cubs series here, and WBEZ out of Chicago had a really cool website that we'll link to. But basically, breaking down the odds, the Cubs, heavy favorites going into the playoffs. Well, theoretically, heavy favorites going into the playoffs to win the World Series. Odds about 21%, which means mm-hmm. 1 in 5, which means the Cubs had, going into the World Series, the Cubs had about as much of a chance of winning as Donald Trump does right now, which people say is a long shot. It's just really interesting that in baseball, of all sports, the best team, one of the best teams in the last 5 or 6 years, regular season-wise, still has a 1 in 5 shot. And it's a little disabling to those of us who want to feel great about our team being so good.
Yeah, see, I almost use that as, I don't know, as a security blanket, to where if it doesn't happen for whatever reason this year, I can say, well, the odds were they weren't going to win anyway.
Baseball's a crapshoot.
Yeah, the playoffs are a crapshoot. I can kind of use that as comfort to a degree. Obviously, I'll still be disappointed, but I can look at it as a see. Even the best team of the last several years only had a 21% chance of winning the World Series.
So I have a question as somebody who – so for me, like, baseball – you always know that there are a lot of baseball statistics, and I guess I'm just one of those people who, even though I like baseball and grew up liking baseball, I still just really know about the basics. Home runs, RBIs, on-base percentage, whatever, ERA. Mm-hmm. Now there are so many – do you feel like having all these statistics at your disposal, if you so choose, ruins the fun? Do you know too much? Is it too much, you know, like taking away the mystery of the game? Because the way I see it is teams, front offices put together teams now based a lot on statistics, correct? Like mm-hmm. what players can do, but also what combinations of players can do and when they do it, I think also. So doesn't that stand to reason that some of the mystery is going to be taken out of the game? If you use statistics so heavily to put your team together, then it stands to reason that the magic is, you know, somebody else is going to use statistics to pick the game apart, I guess.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. Two things. I would say just about every team is trying to do the same thing. So I don't know that it was kind of unique maybe 10, 15 years ago when a guy named Billy Beane was the general manager of the Oakland A's. He was really the first one to kind of try and use advanced statistics to give his team, which didn't have a lot of money to spend, a better chance at winning. And it worked pretty well for them in terms of being competitive. But now I think most teams, if not all, are really utilizing a lot of the same things to try and put their teams together. So I don't think it's any big advantage anymore. And the other thing is, the thing I can compare it to maybe would be Han Solo in Star Wars saying, "Don't ever tell me the odds."
Right.
I think Kid, he puts Kid on the end of that. Never tell me the odds, Kid, I think.
Yeah, because I think it was a C-3PO thing where C-3PO was telling him, "The odds of successfully navigating an asteroid field are like 8,222 to 1, or something along those lines. Never tell me the odds. And so I guess it can diminish the magic in that way. But the other part of it is, part of what makes sports great is that sometimes that 1% thing happens. You know, it just happens. Even if it's unlikely, it still happens because, well, they're real people out there. They're not spreadsheets. And so, the upsets happen. That's what makes sports fun. And I don't think knowing the odds takes away from that.
I think it's also just some of it is like our brains can't really process some of this stuff fast enough. I was looking at a chart of the odds for the game last night with the Cubs were in where, you know, at certain points it was like 40% chance, 30% chance the Giants are going to win. Then they get one hit and all of a sudden it's like 90% and it's back down. It's like, yeah, in real time maybe that's what's happening, but you can't really watch a game like that. The other interesting thing about baseball is you can predict really well what will happen over the course of a season. I think a lot of people before the season, just based on the Cubs team, predicted them to win like 103, 105 games. But individually, that's why the playoffs are so crazy, that you can't really predict very well. But it's across all sports now. When the Golden State Warriors were going into the playoffs, they had like almost a 50% odds. So in basketball, because there's fewer players and better players make a huge difference, and there's sort of less uncertainty. In basketball, the odds of the Golden State Warriors were like 50%. So it's interesting comparing it sport to sport. The other thing that scares me, though, is, and I hate to be like, I don't want to sound like Goose Gossage. we're to the point now where you could probably just get rid of managers, where you would just have a computer, every individual play, every individual thing tell you what's the most likely outcome and just do that. And certain managers like Joe Madden for the Cubs do a very good job of using statistics to their advantage, but don't always rely on it. And I'm just wondering, like, do we get to that point where basically you just have robot managers, you know, whether they're people there, are they just getting fed information where, I mean, if I was a coach, I would want to just do whatever this person is telling me. There's, in fact, one thing I want to bring up. The NFL, New York Times has what they call the fourth down bot, which during every fourth down in the NFL season tells you the chances, percentages of whether or not you should go for that fourth down or not. And it's kind of got a funny sense of humor, so it's a fun follow anyway. But I'm just saying, like,
wait, it's a Twitter account?
Yeah, and it's basically awesome. There to, like, because there's this huge thing in the NFL where you should probably go for it. Percentages tell you to go for it more on fourth down than coaches do because it's risky if you don't. Mm-hmm. So basically it's there to make coaches look dumb.
So I guess I had never thought, and I'm guessing quite a few people have never thought of managers for athletic teams to be possibly automated out of a job.
I mean, I don't think it will ever happen, but like...
But what if it does? I mean, you don't have to pay those guys. You just have a computer barfing out numbers.
Well, it would probably do a better job than 90% of the managers out there in baseball or any sport. I mean, why not?
But this kind of goes back to a conversation that we've had off and on, but probably never officially, about automating refereeing. And it takes a certain human element out of the game that I also know people also want calls to be correct at all times, called correctly by humans. But that's also part of what makes sports sports, is that you have an official, and officials call, in most cases, clean games. They're not throwing games or making calls on purpose or whatever. And sometimes they make mistakes, and some of those mistakes can be lasting, you know, have huge implications or repercussions. But it just it sounds to me, it just hearing you talk about it that way reminds me of this conversation that we've had about officiating. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and I think baseball in particular, I think, is the sport where you see the – not that you don't see second-guessing elsewhere, but it seems like in baseball, every pitching change, every pinch hitter that comes up, every defensive shift.
Well, it's really easier to see that you're playing the percentages, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, you can see, because you have this huge of information, this left-handed pitcher – left-handed batters bat 116 off of him, and this left-handed hitter hits 370 off of right-handed hitters. So you can see these statistics playing in real time, whereas, like, right before Aaron Rodgers throws the ball, you're not saying, well, there's a 34% chance that blah, blah, blah will catch this or whatever, you know?
I have a question about announcers and statistics. Mm-hmm. So now, because there are so many more statistics and ways of getting statistics, how do they, and you've done some of this, I'm sure, how do you manage the flow of information and how do you know what to talk about, what not to talk about, especially if a game is, you know, a game like soccer moves at a different pace than a game like baseball? How do you include stats? I mean, I hear even high school, you know, announcers able to keep up with all the stats and parse them for people. How do you do that?
Well, I think the challenge for an announcer is trying to convey to your audience which statistics matter and which statistics are noise, which are just kind of trivia. For instance, in a lot of cases, how so-and-so has fared against a certain team in his or her career, especially in an era where so many players are changing teams constantly, does that really matter? You know, does it matter how well Jake Arrieta has pitched against the Giants in his career when he hasn't faced half the guys in that lineup?
You having said that made me realize that I'm really hard on the announcers because it's like, oh, of course I know Jake Arrieta.
I wanted to punch Bob Costas in the face the other night. If I heard anything more
just
about
the other night, I mean, come on.
If I heard one more story about, you know, about since 1908, blah 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 blah.
Oh, for the Cubs,
yeah,
well, it's just so unoriginal. It's you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think every every baseball fan knows that the Cubs haven't won a World Series since 1908. And it just seemed like every story he told about the Cubs related to that in some way. And it was like, please stop.
That's Costas, though. He loves the troops.
Yes. Yes, he does. So apologies to Bob Costas, but that's a look at sports and statistics here on this episode of The Bandwagon. All right, folks, it's rivalry time, and it's my turn this week, and I've got one. It was interesting we were talking about announcers because I have a full-fledged rivalry between two baseball announcers.
Oh, that's awesome.
Who would have ever thought it? But yes, this was a full-fledged rivalry. So back in the 1970s, there was an announcer for the Chicago Cubs named Milo Hamilton. He was kind of the second guy in the broadcast booth. Jack Brickhouse was a longtime announcer for WGN for the Cubs. And Brickhouse was getting up there, and Milo Hamilton was a pretty good younger announcer who kind of figured that, okay, once Brickhouse retires, I'll be able to take over kind of the number one play-by-play spot in the Cubs booth, and that'll be cool. But then another announcer by the name of Harry Carey was working across town with the Chicago White Sox, and it just so happened that Harry Carey's contract was up at about the same time the Tribune Company bought the Cubs, and they were really looking to make a splash. So what did the Tribune Company do? They hired Harry Carey to be the number one guy in the TV booth when Jack Brickhouse retired. As you might expect, one Milo Hamilton was not happy about this development. He and Harry worked together in the broadcast booth for one season, 1982, and by all accounts, it was not a pleasant working environment really for either of them. Here's a quote from Milo Hamilton many years later. He was asked what was his favorite among the Cubs telecasts he worked with Harry Carey. It was the final one. And that was the reason enough for it to be his favorite. Here's the quote from Milo. On the last day of the 1982 season, we hadn't even packed up our briefcases yet. We looked at each other and said, well, we made it through the year, and nobody thought we would. The next 2 years I did radio, and it was wonderful working with Lou Boudreau. And then Milo went to Houston, was the Houston Astros announcer for 20, 25 years, was inducted into the announcer's wing there, the Ford C. Frick Award of the Baseball Hall of Fame as the Astros announcer, but he never got over that, ever.
Well, I can imagine that'd be something. And remind me, why did Harry Carey, I know that he was the longtime Cardinals announcer. How did he end up with the White Sox? I don't know that I know that story. Do you?
I know parts of it. There were always rumors that Harry got a little too friendly with the owner's wife.
Ooh.
Of the St. Louis Cardinals. And Harry and Gussie Bush kind of clashed anyway at times because, well, Harry wouldn't exactly mask things on air if the Cardinals weren't doing something well or anything. He wouldn't exactly hide his feelings. So it finally came to a head. And Harry left. I think he went to Oakland for a year or two and then went to Chicago to do White Sox games with Jimmy Pearsall, who was an interesting character in his own right. And he was in Chicago for the White Sox for most of the 1970s.
And who did they bring in? Was it Steve Stone the next year? Or was it?
Yeah, Steve Stone came in. I think it was 83, 84, Steve Stone came into the Cubs booth. I think Stone was there for the 84 season where they won the division.
Steve Stone worked with Harry Carey on the back end and Hawk Harrelson on the back end. That man is doing God's work.
Yes. Yeah, Steve Stone has had some interesting play-by-play announcers.
Yeah, and I don't mean to diminish Harry Carey. He's obviously a huge personality, and obviously this whole situation left a lot of hard feelings. And he was a good announcer before he became a caricature.
Yeah, he was. And I will say this. It probably sounds like I was kind of dumping on Milo Hamilton there with that, you know, and Milo definitely held a grudge. But I think if you hear a lot of the stories about Harry, he could be kind of a difficult guy. I mean, he was not necessarily the easiest guy to work with. there were a lot of announcers who kind of came and went. If you remember how Harry did things, he would be the TV broadcaster for the first three and last three innings of the game. And then he would go over to radio for three innings in the middle, and there would be another announcer who came over to do TV. And they had some really good play-by-play guys who came through in that role. Dwayne Statz, who I think is now the play-by-play guy for the Tampa Bay Rays. Tom Brenneman, who was with Fox for quite a while. I think he still does some stuff for Fox, but he also is the main guy for the Cincinnati Reds now. Josh Lewin, who I think is the TV guy for the Texas Rangers. Lewin only lasted one season with the Cubs, in part because Harry didn't like him. Yeah, that was back in the mid to late 90s. So, yeah, I think you had a couple of good-sized egos there and a couple of pretty good, distinctive play-by-play guys who just were kind of like oil and water.
Your knowledge, your encyclopedic knowledge is impressive. But I guess as an announcer type, it sort of makes sense that you would have researched and looked into these gentlemen's histories. So well done.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was a fun one. I figure with the baseball playoffs,
right,
a couple of announcers who just did not get along.
I like that idea of rival announcers, though, and now I feel the need to sort of investigate further. Yeah.
I thought you were going to go a different direction with this broadcaster rivalry, so now I got one, too.
Oh, all right.
That's good. This will be like a little sub-genre for us.
All right, so that's our rivalry segment for this week. Now let's jump on into our social media nonsense. John Steinbacher, I'll let you lead off today.
Oh, great. well, this isn't we don't normally do super, like, hot topics, but this is kind of a hot topic, especially here. Yesterday, Dee Brown, who had worked for the University of Illinois, calling it social media nonsense because he tweeted out a few things. But surprisingly, after a couple of years working with the University of Illinois basketball team, stepped down for personal reasons. I don't think there's a whole lot of information out there about why exactly. It'll be interesting to see if information comes out. But, you know, it does seem like he's pretty clear that it's personal reasons. So as far as I'm concerned, it's kind of disappointing. I like seeing Dee Brown with the University of Illinois basketball program. He's obviously probably the player of the last 20 years most associated with. He obviously didn't have the success of Darren Williams, but, you know, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. He seemed enthusiastic not only about Illini basketball, but just about student-athletes in general, was always out there promoting Illinois. Seemed sort of had the same personality as Josh Whitman, which is just like, you know, Illinois can and should be the best sports program in the country. So kind of disappointing to see that, but I thought it's worth pointing out. I think Dee Brown seems like a good guy, and it's kind of sad to see. I'm not sure what the circumstances are, but just thought I'd mention it.
Yeah, I think the thing that's I've seen over the last day or so that's gotten my attention, and I think it's one of those it's kind of one of those sports hot takes. And by the time this podcast airs, we'll know whether the LA Dodgers have made the right decision. But there's all this talk about whether they should start Clayton Kershaw today on a 1 day less rest than usual, or whether they should start a young pitcher named Julio Urias, who's very talented but very young. I think he's 20 years old, and let Kershaw pitch if there's a game five in a couple of days, which would be on full rest. It's just interesting seeing all the different elements of that discussion. You've got kind of the hot take is, well, this could be it. If you don't win today, the Dodgers season is over. So the hot take is, well, you got to send your best pitcher out there. That's Kershaw, even if he isn't on full rest. Then the alternative is, well, actually, speaking of our statistics discussion earlier, the stats guys are saying you actually probably have a better chance to win the series if you start the kid today and have a fully rested Clayton Kershaw for a game five.
Yeah, that's a hard decision for a manager to make. You have the supposedly best pitcher in baseball, not necessarily in postseason so far, but, well, I'm glad I'm not. Who is the manager?
Dave Roberts is the manager of the Dodgers, and I believe he has decided to start Clayton Kershaw. And I think, see, that will be the decision that probably is the most justifiable decision for the sports hot take people. But is it the right one? I don't know. So anyway.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Is it my turn now?
It is.
Okay. So my social media nonsense actually comes from something I saw right after we taped our last one. So it's a couple weeks old. But that's okay because I'm dealing with something that's 10 years old here. and I'm going to want some music. So, Brian, I'm going to ask you to give me some music behind me while I'm talking.
Swelling
here.
Music.
So there's going to be some swelling music.
I'll find some music from this particular
thing.
Yes,
yes. So I am talking about Friday Night Lights, a TV show that 10 years ago this month, early this month, late last month, aired its pilot episode on NBC, and I'm going to quote the Grantland.com, the late great Grantland.com oral history introduction, which is what somebody posted it on social media. I was like, oh, what's that? I've never seen that. And I was a big Friday Night Lights fan. And this is from the introduction, in case you don't know what Friday Night Lights is, or if you're like, Brian, you've never seen it before.
I'm a loser.
You're not a loser. It's just I'm surprised. Okay. Inspired by the legendary Buzz Bissinger book Friday Night Lights, A Town, A Team, and A Dream, and the 2004 Peter Berg movie based on it, Friday Night Lights told the story of a high school football coach from Dillon, Texas, whose improbable victories mirrored those of the critically beloved but disastrously rated show itself. In an era when sports television was supposedly at its nadir, is that how you say that? Right? Am I right? Okay. When elite storytelling was supposedly only the work of prestige outlets like HBO and AMC, Friday Night Lights emerged as the quintessential show about American spirit and uplift at a time when the moral and economic bedrock of our country, capital C, seemed most in doubt. So here's a few things about this show. So first of all, I never read the book. I never saw the film. And I didn't start watching the show until the show was probably into its much maligned, and probably for good reason, second season. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I wasn't interested, but I kept saying to my husband, I don't want to watch a show about football. I just don't want to watch a show about football. Who cares? And then for some reason, somebody said, no, Lisa, it's not about football. And I said, okay, I will watch the first episode. So I think we, back in the day when you would rent a video from the video store, this would have been in 2007, maybe.
Yeah, just before Netflix and all that.
Just before all that.
Yeah.
We rented it, and I was absolutely blown away. The storytelling in the pilot, the way that they set up really the rest of the season, but especially that first season, is awesome because of how they turn a trope literally on its head. I'm not going to say anything else, but it absolutely destroys a certain stereotype of football. So there is action. There's football in the show, but it is more of a drama than it is with a football backdrop than it is a show about football with like drama as a backdrop. Right. So, the other reason I liked it was, I grew up until I was 12 in the Deep South and had gone to 1 year of junior high school, in northern Florida, where the football stadium for my junior high school was nicer than most football stadiums in Minnesota, where we moved to after that. And in junior high school, the cheerleaders had five different uniforms. And this is in 1980. Okay, this was a long time ago. So when my husband was like seeing these giant football stadiums for little tiny Texas schools, I was like, that's real. That is absolutely real. And it is absolutely real, the way it was depicted in town, the way people talk about it the next day. There's huge rivalries in, you know, talk about rivalries, and we've talked about pro or semi-pro rivalries between towns. These high school rivalries down there in Texas, Oklahoma, Florida, Georgia, that's a big time. Mm-hmm. I loved that the show is about families and marriage, tragedy, circumstance, geography, struggle, and teamwork, and angst and boredom too. I thought the way that the kids were portrayed, even though all of them were older than high school, all of them, some of them were 30. They did a really great job, I think, of like sort of transmitting, you know, all of these feelings about being in Texas and maybe not having a whole lot to look forward to after high school. And you know, for so many of those folks, high school is definitely the best years of their lives, and that's really what matters. And the other part, and then I'll stop, is that the marriage between the coach and his wife is probably one of the most real depictions of marriage on just like the partnership of marriage on television, right up there with Homer and Marge Simpson and, you know, some other marriages where it's not all perfect and peachy keen. I loved their struggles to individuate from each other, to stay separate people. You know, his wife is not just a football wife, and you know, he's a football coach, but he's also a father, and multidimensional. And then also trying to set themselves apart a little bit, but not too much from everybody else in town, because you want to fit in, but you also want to make your mark. They also have a teenage daughter, so you don't want to be too weird or too awesome. It's like just the way that the family life was portrayed in that show, I thought was just so incredibly well written. Now, that's the first season. The rest of the show was very up and down, but that first season is like TV canon for me. And actually, a rewatch would be really interesting right now, because it was also shot in a time before teenagers had smartphones, before anybody had smartphones. Mm, yeah. So I think the show would actually look really different too, because you know, all of us have this. You know, I'm holding my phone right now, in our hands now, and it's just something that wasn't there. And in that, and I think culturally, having technology literally in the palm of your hand has changed a lot. So I think for that reason, it would be worth a rewatch. The oral history in Grantland, again, is from 2011 when it had been gone or was ending, is a fantastic oral history read if you're into that kind of thing. I really loved it. So that's my social media. I highly recommend Friday Night Lights, Brian.
All right, I'll get on that.
Okay.
Riggins.
Sorry. Yeah, Riggins, man.
Riggins.
Everybody knew a Tim Riggins in high school. Everybody.
Tim Riggins.
I was Tim Riggins in high school.
Really?
No.
Because I would like photo evidence of that.
Absolutely not.
And you know, and then again, that show too. Yes, you can love it for all of the like aesthetic reasons, like Tim Riggins
hair.
Guy.
He Tim was hot. Riggins of the tennis team, were you?
I love Kyle Chandler, and he is actually so perfect as a coach. You see him in these other shows, and you're like, is this even the same guy? He just inhabited that role, the way he wore the clothes, the way he talked. I was just like, wow, you know, like hot coach, man, this is awesome. Just everything about him was just so right. And then Connie Britton, who played his wife and incidentally was in the movie too. She's amazing. She's done other stuff since then. She's great, but to me, that was just the ultimate role for her.
The racial politics are really well done on that show too.
That's true. Oh yeah, again, the first season is just fantastic. Up and down quite a bit for the rest of the time, but they
just
handle
the
a lot.
The second season was bad, and the rest of it's really good.
Yeah, the rest of it was good. There were some parts that had stuff that came later. I was just like, ugh. But especially the introduction of new characters is always really hard for me. I want everything to stay the same. So then when the next wave of youngsters comes through, it's just like, oh, come on. But anyway,
yeah, when,
that's just
when
me.
They adopted that cute little baby. I'm just kidding. I was trying to make a reference to like on the Cosby Show when Rudy got too old.
Nice.
No adoption in this case.
Yeah, I guess they do have a baby, but it's sorry, Brian. Oh my God, shut up, John.
God, I can't believe you just did that.
So many spoilers, John.
Anyway, that's it though. You know, but then they mentioned sports television. I'm like, I don't really know that many other shows that are series about sports. Like, what are they talking
there
about?
There was Sports Night, like, in the 90s that was kind of a cult favorite that I watched just a little bit of, but I never got totally engrossed in.
That's it. No other sports.
I mean, there's, like, the reality ones that are, like, NFL Hard Knocks and stuff like that. But anyway, maybe that's an investigation for another show.
Perhaps.
And there's been sitcoms. Coach! You know, there's been...
Yeah,
which was
I guess I'd forgotten
ostensibly about football, but
this
it was
is too bad.
Just
this
about...
is a podcast because you did like a whole coach thing. It wasn't just saying coach; it was like a performance.
You're kind of him. You're channeling Craig T. Nelson.
We could go so many directions there, but we should probably just wrap this thing up.
Okay, so much talking. All right, are we done?
We're done.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us on the bandwagon. We would especially like to thank our very stressed out guests, Jill Gingler and Katie Heath. Godspeed. I'm knocking four times, and I heard the song jump in my head. The Bandwagon Podcast is produced by John Steinbacher, Brian Moline, and Lisa Braltz. That's me. Thanks to other folks who have helped make The Bandwagon what it is today. Scott Cameron, our news director, Jim Kelly, designed our logo. Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, provide tech support among and moral support, I'd say even, and the band REM. As I like to mention, I'm sure they'd be really excited to know how huge of a difference they've made. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. There you'll find links, show notes, videos that we've talked about. You can subscribe to this podcast and rate it in iTunes. And if you rate us in iTunes, that really does help other people find us. So please do that. Follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants, no vowels, to get our most recent thoughts on stuff, and tweet us your fandoms, your favorite sports-related television, etc. From there, you can also Twitter stalk each of us individually if you're into that, which I guess is fine if you are. Be nice. We love questions, links, recommendations, and etc. Other than that, we'll be back in a couple of weeks to take the temperature of the people in this room, and we'll have a brand new episode if John and Brian survive. Thanks for listening.